It's a great pleasure to be back again this morning with you. For those who weren't here last night, I spoke about the disappearance of human nature and the various factors in our society that are militating against any notion of human nature as a kind of transcendent universal that binds us all together. And what I want to look at today is a specific aspect of the problems that are thrown up by that. How many of you, by the way, went up and looked up Tiger Man on the internet last night? Anybody? Yeah, what did you think? Is he not the weirdest, is it not one of the weirdest things you've ever seen? For those of you who weren't here, Tiger Man was this man who actually tried to have himself surgically changed into a tiger. And sadly, he committed suicide a year or two ago. I guess he was somebody with a lot of, I think the American phrase would be issues. Obviously a blog with a lot of personal problems. But I want to focus today on a particular aspect of, I want to focus on where the issue of the loss of human nature, the issue of the loss of external authority as something that comes to us from outside is becoming a real point of conflict in contemporary society, and that is really identity politics, and specifically sexual identity politics, because I think that is where we're going to feel the rub in the next 10 years or so. And as I was reflecting on this lecture, as I was starting to put it together, it struck me that identity politics is really very, very close to what we might call the politics of victimhood. When you listen to the kind of rhetoric that's used relative to sexual politics, much of it is the kind of rhetoric that one would expect to hear from people trading in victimhood. I had a member of my own church recently. He's a track and cross country member of a track and cross country team at an Ivy League university, and there was a lesbian girl in the track team, and the team decided they were all going to wear rainbow armbands to express solidarity with the lesbian track colleague. And the person concerned called me and said, what should I do about this? I'm not going to do it. I've told them I'm a Christian. I'm not going to do it. What argument should I make? And I said, well, the argument you should make really is sort of the First Amendment one, if you like. You should tell your colleagues that you respect their right to demonstrate their solidarity with their friend in this way. And you would request that they respect your right not to do that. But I did say to him, of course, I said, that won't actually work as an argument. It is the argument, but it won't work because we're not actually arguing about freedom of expression here. We're arguing about everybody being the same so that nobody appears to be being victimized. And lo and behold, he made that argument and was dismissed as homophobic straight away. But it's an example of how the politics of victimhood and identity politics are pressing in, particularly, I think, on the issue of gay, marriage, sexual identity. Talked last night about the loss of human nature, that one can now effectively be whoever one chooses to be, and I think sexual politics is the most obvious example of that. But before we come to address that particular issue, I want to spend a little while reflecting upon the rise of victimhood as a category within social discussion. Because I think the whole notion of what is a victim and who are victims has changed. And unless we understand how that has changed in the last 40 or 50 years, we will not understand the depth of what is going on today. I think it's probably taken different paths in both America and Europe. I'm more familiar, of course, with Europe than I am with America, but I'm going to try to lay out a sort of a skeleton narrative for both sides of the Atlantic. I think in America, slavery and race are the big things that resonate in American culture. There are a number of things that make it hard to be a foreigner in America, and one of them is we don't understand how race functions here. I've sort of made a promise to myself that I will never comment in any forum whatsoever on racial politics because I simply don't understand exactly how it cuts up in American culture. We have racism back in Europe, but it tends to be more related to immigration, if I could put it that way, and tends to be focused more on people from the Indian subcontinent, certainly in Britain, than on people of African origin. In America, I think slavery looms large as an issue and shapes an awful lot of how people think about victimhood. And that feeds, of course, into the civil rights discussions and struggles of the 50s and 60s. And that's not insignificant for contemporary struggles over sexual identity, because if you read the sort of materials being produced by the gay rights lobby, one will notice that the rhetoric of civil rights is very powerful, that there is a conscious parallel being drawn between the struggles for gay equality and the kind of struggles that went on for racial equality in the 1950s and 1960s. So that's very much part of the background in America. I think in terms of the ideology of what's going on, though, probably more significant in some ways is what went on in Europe. And I'll spend a little bit more time reflecting upon Europe, because Europe is the origin of Marxism, for example, which I think is a very powerful, has proved a very powerful and potent social theory in shaping the way people think. Obviously, there's some recent events that frame victimhood for Europeans. The Holocaust would be the most obvious. But I think more powerful still, going back in time, is the Industrial Revolution. If you go back to the 19th century, particularly in Britain, which was the sort of the mechanized center of the universe at that particular point in time, Britain was, if you like, it was the sort of the United States. What the United States was in the 20th century, Britain was in the 19th century. I noticed, somebody sent me recently a map which showed all the countries that Britain has never invaded, and I think there are only like six of them in the entire world. And one of them, Sweden, and I think any country that produces the pop group ABBA, we've got to invade them and teach them a lesson at some point. So I expect Sweden to fall at some point. If ever ABBA get back together, I think the British Prime Minister would have to do something. Britain was a very powerful nation. It was built on exports. Our empire was an exporting empire. Britain was the industrial center of the 19th century. And if you've read any 19th century literature, you know about the industrial poverty that generated. Thomas Carlyle, one of the great Victorian writers, wrote a book, Past and Present, where he longs for the Middle Ages, because he sees the urban, mechanized sprawl of the Industrial Revolution as dehumanizing people. Thomas Chalmers, the great 19th century Scottish Presbyterian churchman, who was wrestling with the fact that his parish in Glasgow was just exploding in numbers, and what was he as a parish churchman to do, wrote many articles on the diaconal ministry. Why did he do that? Because the Industrial Revolution was placing huge pressure on him because of the urban poverty that he was having to face. Chalmers, just as a bit of Chalmers trivia, he is the only Scottish Presbyterian mentioned in Das Kapital by Karl Marx. Marx refers to him as the arch-parson. He didn't think very highly of Chalmers's economics at all. Charles Dickens. Many of Dickens's books, of course, are set against the background of the devastation of that the Industrial Revolution brought in its wake. On the one hand, it brought great wealth to the nation as a whole, but it brought much poverty and deprivation to many individual families. And perhaps maybe the most significant piece of Victorian literature on this would be Friedrich Engels' Condition of the Working Class in England and Scotland. Interestingly enough, it's a piece of Marxist journalism, but much of the detail in that book is drawn from parish newsletters, because it was ministers who were on the front line of urban poverty and were ministering to people in the urban situation. And as a response to this, well, you know, the greatest, one might say, the most intellectually influential response to this was, of course, Karl Marx and Marxist theory. And Marx saw the problem in 19th century as being the inappropriate distribution of capital. And what I think is key to grasp in this is not, you know, Marxist theory, I think, has been very successfully debunked both by history itself and by various critics. But what I think emerges is the notion of victimhood specifically linked to economic conditions. Victimhood is an economic problem, and it's to be sorted, as far as Marx is concerned, by revolution. Interestingly enough, I was traveling through North London a couple of years ago with the president of Westminster, and we were going through Highgate on the tube, and I said to him, "Do you know who's buried in Highgate?" And he said, "No." And I said, "Karl Marx." And he said, "No, he's buried in Moscow." He's an American. His grasp of European history is fairly slim. Actually, my youngest son, I don't normally brag about my sons, but my youngest son, who is British to the tips of his fingers, at his school, he won the Daughters of the Revolution American History Prize. And he said there was nothing more satisfying than knowing American history better than Americans know it. He said, but anyway, I say Karl Marx is buried here. So we hop off the train and we walk a mile and a half to Highgate Cemetery and we pay our pound to get in and we spend the afternoon rummaging around in this overgrown cemetery until we finally find Marx's grave. And it's this huge bust of Marx, giant thing, giant bust, marble bust of Marx over his grave. And two things struck me about this grave. When he was buried in the late 19th century, he was poor and he was virtually unknown. And Engels makes this speech at the side of Marx's grave. It's pouring with rain, and he makes this speech about how within 50 years, everybody on the face of the globe would know the name of this man. And I imagine if you were walking through the graveyard that day, you'd have thought he was a loony. Pouring with rain, weedy, beardy guy making this speech. Absolute loony. What a chilling prediction that was. The other thing that struck me was that all around the grave were these graves of communist leaders from around the world. One of the leaders of the Mexican Communist Party was buried there. And it struck me as interesting that these radical materialists had their bodies sent halfway around the world to be buried next to Marx. And it seemed a complete contradiction of everything they stood for. Anyway, that's my rant. Let's move back to the narrative. What really emerges at the start of the 20th century then is, and Marx is the great example of this, but certainly not the only one. I think we also see it in the struggle over slavery, Reconstruction, civil rights of the 50s, is oppression is seen as an economic category. Sometimes it has legal manifestations. A slave is the property of an owner. But by and large, these things reflect economic realities. That is not the case anymore. And the reason why that's not the case, or the story why that's not the case, I think is significant for understanding why arguments about identity work the way they do today. First of all, we have the massive failure of Soviet communism. You know, the dream was the Russian Revolution is meant to liberate, supposed to bring the proletariat to the top of the historical pile. It's meant to liberate everybody. It ends up being probably the most murderous regime in history. Even the Nazis couldn't sort of achieve quite the numbers that Stalin managed to achieve in the Soviet Union. And the collapse of Soviet communism led to a general collapse of Marxist theory. Except it didn't. What happened is that Marxist theory gets transformed, and we'll talk about that transformation in a moment. The second thing that happens in the 20th century, in addition to the impact of Marx and then the changing of Marxist theory, the impact of Sigmund Freud. Freud, I think, is a very, very significant figure for contemporary identity politics. Freud is somewhat complex in his thinking, but essentially he sees human beings as having two great drives, sex and death. And he wrote a very important book in 1929 entitled Civilization and Its Discontents. And in this book, he really sees civilization as the product of the curbing of these instincts. You can't have people going around, you know, fulfilling their death wish on other people. So we pass laws about murder and we punish people who murder people. Civilization. You can't have people going around, you can't have men going around and just getting any woman they want pregnant. So we develop laws and we have informal ways of controlling men's sexual appetites to sort of corral them towards monogamy, if you like. What's significant, I think, about this sort of thinking is that we see a move towards seeing repression, or one might say oppression, to being a psychological category. And that's important. 19th century, oppression is economic on the whole. You're oppressed because you're too poor to buy food for your family or put shoes on your children's feet. Freud's really thinking about oppression in a different way. That which curbs your appetites, that stops you from being who you really want to be. And what happens in the wake of the collapse of Marxist theory in the sort of the economic realm is that Marx and Freud get fused. In the 1950s, we have the emergence of what's now called the New Left. Now, Herbert Marcuse, German thinker, very influential in this. Marcuse starts to see oppression as a psychological thing. That the middle classes impose their morality on other people to prevent them being who they truly are. And this, I think, is where it's starting to become significant for where we are today. Because when you look at the language of the gay rights lobby, they will use the language of oppression. And on one level, that seems ridiculous to us. They're not oppressed. But within the framework they operate, they see themselves as being oppressed because they're not being able to fulfill their inner drives, if you like, in the way that they wish to do so. So while we see the language, the fusion, if you like, of civil rights language and gay lobby language as being inappropriate, I think when you see the way that the new left thinking has moved, taking oppression from being an economic category to being a psychological category, we can see the legitimacy, certainly from their perspective, of what is going on there. So, victimhood then becomes, in the 1950s and 1960s, it becomes less a matter of economic oppression, less a matter of what people are doing with your bodies, and more a matter of what people are doing with your mind. Think of the rhetoric when, we see it, certainly we've seen it in Britain, I think you see it over here. Famous sports player comes out, runs off with another guy and leaves his wife and kids behind. And the rhetoric is all about how liberated he feels. The rhetoric is not about the damage he's done to the wife and kids, and sometimes they're even presented as the oppressors. They've been forcing him to what? To be something he really isn't. Psychological oppression, I think, by way of Marx and Freud, has come to the center. We could add other factors to this as well. I think the affluence of the West has fed into this. I talked a bit last night about how we see, let's not play the Pharisaical, I thank you, Lord, I'm not like other men, and just point at the gay rights lobby. Do we not feel this in all of ourselves? That self-fulfillment has become an important category for all human beings everywhere in the West. What is life about? It's about fulfilling oneself. I used the example of my grandfather last night. My grandfather worked in a tedious job, but it didn't matter because it wasn't the intrinsic entertainment value of the job he did that counted. It was the fact that God led to him the job led to him being able to put food on the table, clothes on his kids' back, clothes on his kid's back, shoes on his kid's feet. I'm sort of getting... I slept in a hotel last night. You never sleep that great, which means your neural pathways, if they haven't altered, are at least slightly confused in the morning. But now we're in a world where self-fulfillment is part of the everyday patois that we talk to each other. Do you find fulfillment in your job? Maybe we should be thinking about trying to find fulfillment from our jobs would be a better way of thinking about it. We also witness, I think, as victimhood has moved to being a psychological category, we've moved to what I would call the middle classization of victimhood. Everybody's a victim now. It's always stunning to me how many celebrities were sexually abused as children. I don't want to sort of cast aspersions on any individual accusation, but it strikes me as inherently unlikely that so many people were sexually abused when they were children. Everybody has to be a victim. It's interesting. I'm not a big fan of Rick Warren's theology, but I am aware that Rick Warren and his church have given a considerable amounts of money to projects that socially liberal people should be in support of. Clean water in Africa, those kind of things. Rick Warren has not been stingy in allowing his church's money to be used to help poor people. And I think that's a great thing. I think that's an admirable quality. It was interesting when he was asked to do the prayer at the first presidential inaugural for the current president. The howls of protest that came because of his position on homosexuality and gay marriage. Nothing that he'd done for the poor, the traditional people that the traditional left would have a concern with, nothing that he'd done for them counted for anything over against his theoretical opposition to homosexuality and gay marriage. And that, I think, was emblematic of the way that victimhood has become a middle-class thing. It's more significant, it's less significant to provide clean water for Africa than it is to make sure that Melissa Etheridge can marry her lesbian partner. That's not a slap. That's just a statement of fact coming from the events of 2008, 2009. Victimhood has become a very, very middle class thing. So victimhood is a category, a psychological category now. I think we can turn to think about the nature of sexual politics. Well, first of all, I want to give a Christian take on this. I find St. Augustine very helpful on this particular issue. I think Augustine would look at our current state, the obsession with sex in our society, and I think he might be prepared to agree with Freud on one or two points. I think Augustine would say, yes, our obsession with sex, going back to something I said last night, is a means of avoiding death. Somebody drew my attention to a scene in a movie from about 20 years ago with Cher. I'm not a big Cher fan, either musically or acting-wise, but he said it's a movie where I think it's Olympia Dukakis, plays an older wife whose husband is just a philanderer, and he's had affair after affair after affair. And at some point in the movie, she points a finger at her husband and says, "You're still going to die." It's a very profound statement, very Augustinian statement in some ways, in that she was putting her finger on the fact that, you know, sex is a way of distracting ourselves from death. For Augustine, what is sex? Sex is, it's an act of self-love. Human beings are designed to love God. But in the fall, we con ourselves into thinking that we are God, and therefore it's natural that we love ourselves. For fallen human beings, it's natural that we love ourselves. And so I think Augustine would look at the world in which we now live and say, well, this is simply the final logical unraveling of what happened in the fall. There is an honesty, if you like, about the world in which we now live, when it's very clear what fallen humanity is about. It's always been about self-fulfillment. Now it's obviously, patently, openly about self-fulfillment. fulfillment. So the first comment I would like to make is that nothing we're facing now as a Christian church should surprise us. Like in some ways, we're just seeing society and culture being more open and honest about what the game has been all along. Coming out of sexual politics, mentioned last night, I think human nature has by and large gone. Not even your body, not even the body that was given to you at birth, has any authority over you now. You can have it altered by surgery if you wish. We talked about Douglas and Donna, the serial killer and his alter ego last night. Man and woman have gone. Interestingly enough, gender is now on the way out as well. I was reading a short article by a Roman Catholic friend the other week, David Mills, who was writing an article on something he'd read about transgender rock bands. I find the whole idea of a transgender rock band, for various reasons, to be a complete contradiction in terms. But he noted how it's now being written trans star gender, not just transgender, because, of course, it implies, to say somebody is transgender implies that there is such a thing as gender that one can contradict or step over from. And that's a construct that has been imposed. We've now got to the point where even transgender, it's going to become a hate term at some point because it depends upon anachronistic categories of gender. Human nature have gone, man and woman have gone, gender has gone. What is left? Complete self-creation. Now think about that. Connect that back to what I said a few moments ago about oppression being a psychological category. If all that's left is complete self-creation, then anybody who stops you being what you want to be is oppressing you. They're stopping you being authentic and faithful to yourself. And it's important to understand that because that lies at the heart, I think, I've heard this argument used. Well, the church can get out from under the allegation of engaging in hate crimes about gay marriage by saying, well, you know, gay marriage and homosexuality is not the only thing we object to. We also object to sex before marriage between a man and a woman. And that's true. But I think there's a fundamental difference between those two things. To object to sex before marriage is to object to an illegitimate outlet for a legitimate identity. When you question gay marriage or homosexuality, you're actually questioning somebody's fundamental identity. And this is why I would say that there's a sense in which the civil rights idiom, when the civil rights idiom is applied to the gay issue, I would have to say there is a sense in which it is appropriate to do that. It's appropriate to do that because the civil rights discussions were about identity. And if you're a gay person being told that homosexuality is wrong, you're not simply being told that it's not like being told that you shouldn't speed on the highway. You're actually having somebody question how you think about your identity at its most fundamental level. So on that level, I think the analogy is appropriate. I think it's thoroughly inappropriate in a whole host of other ways. For example, I don't think gay people have ever been regarded as somebody else's property in a way that a slave is a property of a master. I don't think they've ever been subject to vigorous campaigns of stopping them from voter registration, for example. I think there are all kinds of ways in which the analogy is not appropriate. But I think as Christians, we need to understand this is a discussion about identity, not just sexual morality or immorality. Secondly, I think we need to understand how we've got to the place we've got to. I remember being involved in a discussion 20 years ago, and I put this comment that I made down. I've made a lot of boneheaded comments in my time, but this is right there at the top of all the boneheaded things I've ever said. We were discussing the issue of homosexuality, and I made the comment, look, it'll never gain traction in society because it's so obviously wrong. That was just 20 years ago. And that was a plausible argument to make 20 years ago. It's unbelievable, isn't it? Just 20 years ago, you could have made that as a plausible argument. What I failed to understand was that the society's morality would not ultimately be changed because of arguments. Society's understanding of this would be changed because of what I call aesthetics. There's a great book by Robert George. Robert George is rapidly becoming one of my intellectual heroes of the moment. He's a Roman Catholic. He's a professor of law at Princeton University. He team teaches with a guy called Cornel West. It must be an amazing course to have team talk, because Cornel West is far to the left and Robert George is really a very conservative figure. Robert George has written a brilliant book defending the traditional definition of marriage that I think has persuaded absolutely nobody to change their mind. It's a brilliant book. You know, you were to read it. The arguments are brilliant. The problem is the battle was not lost because the argument was lost. The battle was lost without any arguments really ever having been made in the first place. I think the more powerful than arguments on this one has been soap operas, sitcoms, the consistent portrayal of immorality as attaching to very nice and decent people. And let's face it, a lot of nice and decent people out there, and we all have our immoral aspects to us. I think sexual morality in general has been transformed by the televisual media. And I think the issue of homosexuality has been transformed by the role of the narratives, the aesthetics, etc., of the television and of the movies. Think about it. I mean, it's not directly connected to homosexuality, but think about the Oscars. I never watched the Oscars. It just seems to me an absolutely ghastly thing. And if you look back at the history of movies, you know that the best movies never win the Oscars anyway. But the red carpet there, you can imagine people tuning in and they see these good-looking, fit guys and they see these beautiful women and they parade up and they're photographed. And let's face it, there's something in all of us that wants to be like them. I'd love to have a full head of hair, you know. Man, that would be great. I did have a full head of hair once. It kind of brings a lump to my throat to think about it with nostalgia. Now, my wife is 4'9". She'd love to be 5'8", I'm sure. You know, we look at these people and we want to be them. But then when you think about, you know, how many abortions, how much infidelity, how much immorality those people represent, if we could see them as they really are, it would be an abomination, would it not? But it isn't an abomination. It's beautiful and we want to be like them. It's powerful. It's like standing, I don't know if you've ever stood at Niagara Falls. Maybe I'm weird, but I've been there a couple of times. And I stand at the edge and there's something in me just wants to jump in. You just want to feel that power pulling you away. I think that that's what the televisual media can be like. We see these soap operas, we see these beautiful, delightful people, and we want to be like them. And that has had more profound effect on how people think about sexual morality than any book that Robert George will ever write. And his arguments are brilliant. I think his arguments are unanswerable. But there's no need to answer his arguments because the argument was never lost. The argument was never even addressed. So the power of the media in a positive way in presenting these things as beautiful and, of course, in presenting critics as hateful. Fred Phelps has gone to his eternal reward this week, I believe. But Fred Phelps became the poster child, did he not, for the media on anybody who opposed gay marriage. And how many of us here would want to identify with Fred Phelps? That's not the Christian approach to these things. But on the one hand, you have the beautiful Hollywood types. On the other hand, you have the spittle-dripping Fred Phelps picketing the funerals of men who were killed fighting for their country abroad. Powerful aesthetic presentations that shape the way people think. And the language of hate has been used to delegitimize debate. I mentioned yesterday Ryan Anderson, very thoughtful individual who's again written very well on issues relating to marriage and sexual morality. Brian Anderson was barred, I think, just this week from presenting the case against gay marriage at Stanford University. Universities, of course, are meant to be places where ideas can be circulated and debated and tested to see if they are valid and strong or not, but apparently that is no longer the case. This is from the Stanford Daily, and I quote, "Last Wednesday evening, the Graduate Student Council denied funding for an event hosted by the Stanford Anscombe Society following community outcry over alleged anti-LGBT content." Now listen to the language of the second paragraph. This paragraph is interesting. "Bringing the speakers to Stanford would threaten the safety of campus for the queer population, according to Brianna Huntsman, class of 15, who started a Facebook event to organize a rally at the GSC meeting on Wednesday night. Quotes, "A lot of students who are queer come to Stanford because it's one of the most LGBT-friendly places in the world," Huntsman said. "I grew up in Utah where it was really conservative, and a lot of us come from similar backgrounds, and we feel that every time we go home, Stanford is supposed to be a safe space for us." Now, just listen to that. The language of danger and safety is being used there. That's powerful rhetoric. That's not addressing the arguments. It's delegitimizing the arguments even before they have been made. We might say, well, safe from what? Well, the answer is safe from an argument. Well, you might respond and say, but an argument's not dangerous. Ah, remember, repression is a psychological category. And being told you are wrong is oppressive. And dangerous. The danger, one might say, is all in the mind, in every sense of the word, I think there. Notice the passion, as I said. It's all about identity. I think if Ryan Anderson had been turning up to speak against premarital sex, there wouldn't have been such an outcry. Because premarital sex is not an identity issue in the way that homosexuality is. That's why, as I said, the parallels between heterosexual, premarital heterosexual sex and gay marriage don't work. The former is to oppose an illegitimate expression of a legitimate identity. To oppose the latter is to question the legitimacy of somebody's own self-created identity. So what should the church's response to this be? I've got a couple of points here. And I have to say, my thinking on this is definitely a work in progress. So I'm not presenting these as definitive in any way whatsoever. The first thing seems to me to be rather obvious, and that is we need to think clearly about the issues. And that operates at a number of different levels. One, I think we need to understand why people are thinking the way they do. And that involves knowing the history of the gay rights movement. It involves knowing the history of victimhood and how victimhood is understood. If you don't understand that, then you will be making statements such as, well, we object to heterosexual sex before marriage and expecting that to work, and it's not going to work. I think we also need, as a church, to recapture an understanding of God's holiness and of sin as sin against God. Why do I say that? I think it's going to become very, very hard in the next 5 or 10 years to hold the line on identity politics relative to sexuality in the West. It's going to be very, very hard to hold the line on that. And unless one has a good theological foundation, one won't be able to do it. I read something, even in the last 12 months, I read something written by a reformed, respectable reformed guy, saying that we need to remember that sin is that which disrupts relationships between human beings. That's a true statement. Sin certainly does disrupt relationships between human beings. But that is not what sin is at its most fundamental level. Sin at its most fundamental level is that which disrupts the relationship between a creature and a holy God. And I worry that if we're not making that latter point, it'll be very, very hard to hold the line on sexual politics. If I'm saying to, if two men come to my church and present themselves before me and say, we want to get married, will you marry us? And I say, no, I'm sorry, I won't marry you. I'm disrupting the relationship between them. Why would I not allow two people who love each other to get married? Unless I have an understanding of sin as primarily against the holy God. And this is where I would commend to you David Wells' new book, God in the Whirlwind. It's excellent. Don't believe the very silly review that James K.A. Smith did in Christianity Today when he said, you know, every time I read David Wells' new book, I realize I'm reading the last book he wrote. That's not the case. David does something new and interesting in this book. And I think what he does well is he places holiness right at the center of his doctrine of God as something that has to be coordinated with God's love, because that's the only thing that can give a coherent understanding of sin. Secondly, I think we need to beware of overreaction. I said the other week to somebody, you know, if I see another book on biblical manhood being written, I think I'm going to buy a plane ticket, I'm going to fly out to wherever that person's living, and I'm going to beat them to death with it. You know, it's biblical manhood, you know, enough already. I know that there are big issues about relationships between men and women that need to be addressed, but we have enough Americans who've written books on biblical manhood where they're really writing about John Wayne, I think, to last us for an entire lifetime. Beware of overreaction. I think we need to be careful that even as the world zeroes in and obsesses over these things, we as a church need to maintain, I'm going to talk about this a little bit in the last lecture, we need to maintain a confessional identity. And that is why we have to respond to the world. Our job is to teach the whole counsel of God. And that means that we don't want every sermon to be on biblical manhood, nor do we want every sermon to be on what's wrong with the gay rights movement. We're to teach the whole counsel of God. We need to beware of overreacting to these things. Thirdly, I think we need to beware of what I would describe as aesthetic reactions. There's a great temptation when faced with the matters of sexual identity and sexual politics for us to engage in the same kind of arguments or non-arguments that have swung the pendulum the wrong way. I remember somebody wrote recently about what they called the yuck factor, that we mustn't forget the yuck factor when it comes to the matter of homosexual sexual activity. And I grew up in the 1980s. I went to an all-boys rugby-playing school in the United Kingdom. You know, homosexuality, you know, we were, in the true sense of the word, homophobic, if I could put it that way. The yuck factor works for me. But the yuck factor is a very subjective thing. You know, I've met people who don't like to kiss on the lips because all they can think about is the germs that are being transferred. The yuck factor is very, very subjective as an argument. And it makes me, I mentioned last night that I'm wondering if intuitive arguments can be helpful. I think maybe intuitive arguments, you know, would a man marry a dog? I think they can be very helpful one-on-one, but I'm not sure that one can build ultimately a macro argument on intuitive arguments. For example, I don't know how many of you followed, I don't just follow weird lawsuits on the internet, but they are kind of, there's a grisly fascination to them, if I could put it that way. It's like watching society in a sort of overall train wreck situation. You're horrified, but you're also fascinated at the same time. Don't know whatever happened to this, but a year or two ago, a Columbia professor at the University of Columbia, was arrested and charged with having an incestuous relationship with his daughter. It's repellent. You know, we recoil from that. I don't know what the result of the case was, but I remember I printed off some of the court documents that I found online, and I showed them to the seminary lawyer, good friend of mine. And I handed him, I say, hey, Jim, what do you think of this? How would you defend this case? And his comment to me was, you know, with the legal precedents that have been set relative to gay marriage, where it really comes down to consent, because the daughter was an adult and was consenting, he said, I think you could make a very good legal defense of this. that if this man goes to prison, he said, it will purely be because there's a gut revulsion at what he's done. Legally, he said, and Jim is a very, very good lawyer, Jim said, I think I could defend this man on the basis of legal precedents that have already been set. And that struck me as interesting, that we have to be careful when we use aesthetic arguments, because what is today disgusting is tomorrow perfectly acceptable practice. And so I think we need to avoid aesthetic reactions, and we need to maybe develop some intuitive arguments, but be aware that intuitive arguments may work well one-on-one with individuals, but may not carry the day as macro arguments. I also think we need to see the bigger picture. I mentioned this last night. I think that we need not to panic over much over what is happening relative to gay marriage, on the grounds that I think marriage itself was redefined many years ago. I love 19th century literature. Thomas Hardy was redefining marriage. If you haven't read Jude the Obscure, I love depressing books. They don't come any more depressing than Jude the Obscure. If you want to know about the English class system, read Jude the Obscure. Hardy never wrote another novel after he'd finished Jude the Obscure because he got so many hits for what he was doing with marriage in that book. And yet, Hardy ultimately won. Marriage has become a sentimental bond designed for self-fulfillment. I mentioned yesterday, as I was driving through Philadelphia on Thursday on my way back from Cairn University, I saw a billboard saying, no-fault divorce, $295. That's all it costs to get out of marriage. I would go home to my wife and say, you need to behave. $295 and I can be out of here, man. I wouldn't dare do that, I have to say. Of the two of us, I suspect she's the one who'd be going to the lawyer with the $295. So, anyway, marriage became a sentimental bond for self-fulfillment some time ago. And gay marriage is in some ways merely the logical outworking of that. And I don't recall the church making a big stink about no-fault divorce. And I'm not sure that the church nationwide has made a big stink about disciplining people in no-fault divorces. I think the church has to accept a certain amount of responsibility for what's going on. Marriage, the foundational definition of marriage, was legally redefined, practically redefined, some time ago. And if you read the Robert George book on marriage, What is Marriage is the title. You can get it on Kindle. It's about 100 pages. George makes that case, I think, in an irrefutable form. That brings me to my last two points. I suspect the answer we're looking at here might be local rather than macro. I was very, very struck reading Rosaria Butterfield's book, Secret Thoughts of an Unlikely Convert. If you haven't read it, you should read it. I think it's one of the most important Christian books, one could hyperbolically say, ever written, but I certainly think it's one of the most important books for this current age that's out there. Rosaria Butterfield was a professor of queer theory, I think it's Syracuse University, and is now the wife of a Reformed Presbyterian pastor in the Carolinas. A number of people have said to me, I gave the book out at church, and I had to buy a new pile, because people just wanted to read this thing. A number of people said that they thought she overdid it, because in towards the end she makes a case for exclusive psalmody. I actually think, from a literary perspective, that chapter is very important. It doesn't, there's no more dramatic a conversion, I think, than from professor of queer theory at Syracuse University to homeschooling exclusive psalmody mum. That's a powerful, powerful conversion story. What's most powerful in that work, I think, is the way she was led to Christ. And it wasn't somebody making a powerful macro argument against homosexuality. It starts off, she's going to give a lecture on her topic, a public lecture, and she receives a lot of hate mail from local Christians. But one local pastor writes to her and simply asks her to join him and his wife for dinner. And they strike up this weird and unlikely friendship, where over a period of time, he just sits and listens to her. And he kind of earns the right as a friend to Tell her about the gospel. And I wonder if that's the, you know, we spend a lot of our time thinking about macro solutions. We need a great book that's going to deal with this decisively. We need legislation that's going to deal with it. I wonder if actually the solution to the challenge that the gay rights and gay marriage presents us with, actually it's going to be worked out in 1,000 local places, not in one centralized place. It's going to be 1,000 Christians being kind and good to their gay neighbors that's going to buy them the space to speak the truth, the holy truth, in love to them. And then finally, and I mentioned this last night, I think we need to brace ourselves for the fact that the gospel is going to look increasingly like madness. If the language of civil rights is being applied to sexual politics today, it is only a matter of time before the language of white supremacy is being routinely applied to those who oppose it. I think that the person who opposes gay marriage in 10 years' time is going to look like a person in the Ku Klux Klan today, quite probably. And there's probably nothing we can do about that. Rejoice that the Lord has called us to live in this particular time and be good witnesses for him, I think. But I think it helps us to know what's coming and to be aware that we're going to have a lot of hateful epithets thrown our way. The key, of course, is not to respond in a hateful manner. That's all I have to say for the second lecture. And the third lecture, I want to talk about Paul's solution to the problems of his day that are very similar to problems our day. Oh, one last thing I forgot to mention. It occurred to me, and I'd make a note of it. The other thing to note is the unusual nature of our times. I should have said this earlier, but it's often said there have been, you know, homosexuality has existed throughout history. Absolutely. Absolutely has. I did classics as my undergraduate degree, spent an awful lot of time reading Greek poems written by one guy writing to another guy. Homosexuality has been part of culture, broad Western culture, for a long, long time. The difference today is it's become a fundamental marker of identity. That was never the case in the ancient world. Yes, men would engage in homosexual activity. It was often a phase they passed through. In our world, it has become an absolute hallmark of identity in a way that I think is utterly unprecedented in history. That's useful to know when you're talking to gay friends, because they may well play the, well, you know, it's been going on throughout history. Yes, but it functions very differently today. That is one point of dramatic discontinuity between our age and ages past. Time for questions, Greg?
I've never found it more changing as a Christian and challenging in, let's say, the last 4 years to be a witness in the workplace. And do you see any work in the universities or those sorts of things, like studying how to connect with this new culture in a way that you can personally meet someone without being completely marginalized by the first mention that you're a Christian? Is anyone studying that?
I'm not aware of anyone studying that. Now, at a church level, I mean, Tim Keller in New York has spent a lot of time reflecting on how to speak to the Manhattan crowd, which I guess is very similar to the kind of environment you're talking about. I have hesitations about some of the things that he does. I think he tends to, you know, I'd put idolatry alongside biblical manhood as something where we got enough books on that. I mean, the emphasis on idolatry is a good thing that is stressed to the exclusion of God and everything else. I think that, to an extent, that only takes us thus far. Sin is against God at the end of the day. It isn't just a good thing stressed to the exclusion of all else. It's also a bad thing against God. But I do think that Tim Keller's done a lot of good work on, you know, how do we deploy our language in these situations. So he'd be the one guy that I would think about. But we are increasingly going to be obviously resident aliens, I think, in the world in which we live. And that's why I go back to Rosaria Butterfield's book and think it's the outward manifestation that's going to get people interested. You're dying of cancer. Why aren't you crying all the time? Why do you seem to have hope even amidst your sorrow? I think it's going to be things like that that will lead to the questions that, you know, as is said in the New Testament, give us a chance to give a reason for the hope that is within us. So I suspect witnessing and evangelism will move more into that kind of realm, where one-on-one people will just observe how you behave, and at some point they'll say to you, why do you behave in that particular way? I'm always glad on a plane when the person next to me doesn't ask me what I do. Because you always think, oh, as soon as I tell them I teach at a seminary or I'm a pastor of a church, they're going to think I'm a loony. And, you know, it's either going to be a very hostile conversation or a very hostile silence. And I have it easy compared to you guys who work in the secular world. That's another thing that I get sick to death of, is ministers telling what a hard life they have. I think pretty much everybody in my congregation has a harder life than I have, because they've spent most of their days working with non-Christians and wrestling with the kind of questions you're wrestling with. I have a comparatively easy life compared to that. I hate a lot of things, as you can see. They're all coming out one after the other.
You mentioned in your presentation about how if two gay men were to present themselves to you to marriage, and then if you said no, you're attacking their identity. At the same time, they're attacking your identity, I guess, and your relationship with God. That argument I understand. But now, how do we address the Christian business person, the wedding caterer, the baker for the cakes, who refuses to do a marriage for a gay couple, because of what they believe to be true? I mean, what advice do we give to that fellow Christian in that situation?
That's a tough one. I mean, one of my deacons asked me recently. He's a piano tuner, and he tunes pianos for a couple of gay couples. And he was sort of saying to me, you know, what should I do about this? I said, well, you can assume that all of the people you're tuning pianos for are immoral in some way. And my response to him, maybe it was a cop-out, was you need to act in accordance with your conscience. You know, as a session, we're not going to discipline you if you tune the piano of a gay person. My wife's hairdresser, great guy, great friend of hers, he's a gay guy. He lives with another man and does my wife's hair superbly, and we have no problem in paying him to cut her hair. We're not paying him to live with a gay guy, we're paying him to cut her hair. I think when you come to something like a wedding cake, then it's getting... that gets harder, like a wedding cake or wedding photographer. Are you approving of that which you are photographing or providing a cake for? And again, the couple living together analogy doesn't help there, because actually, of course, we all want couples who are living together to marry so that they sort of legitimize what they're doing. So,
do you make an argument and say, well, does everyone you serve, does everyone you provide a service for, live a holy and righteous life? You know, or are you supporting the philanderer by catering their event?
Yeah. I think I would still see a gay wedding as different, because there's a certain, what the word is, constitutional, institutional structure there that you're participating in. But I suppose for me, I've got to be honest and say, I'm a work in progress on this. This is a relatively new issue. It's not something I face directly. My instinct at this point would be, well, first thing I'd do is I'd call all my elders together and we'd discuss it as a group so that I could get wisdom from them as well. So if it happened today, if I get a phone call during the break and somebody's, my church says to me, I've been asked to produce a cake for a gay wedding, what should I do? My advice today would be, act in accordance with your conscience, and the session will support you in that, until we've come to a settled opinion on it. But this is where I find the legal judgment in that case very sinister. You know, when the legal judgment in, I think it was the way, I can't remember if it was the catering case or the photography case, where one of the judges, I think it was a sort of judge's opinion rather than the final official one, but where he made the statement there, you know, about the price you pay for business in the public square is you have to set aside your private religious convictions. That to me seems of a piece with the way legislation has been moving in this country, where freedom of religion is increasingly being defined as freedom to worship rather than freedom to be religious in the public square. And I found the legal language there disturbing. And I think the Hobby Lobby case also you know, it's not quite the same, but it relates to the same sort of legal trajectory. So more worrying for me is less the how I would advise an individual congregant to what the legal judgments coming down in these cases mean for religious freedom. I wonder if I asked Elton John to perform at my wedding and was willing to meet his price, and he refused to do it because I'm an OPC minister, would I be able to sue him? Would I be able to take him to court? And I suspect not, and that points to the way politics is playing into these legal decisions as well.
Thank you.
There's no need to thank me, actually, because I didn't answer your question. I don't think I simply said I don't know. So, and would you cater for a Unitarian wedding or a Unitarian funeral where blasphemy will have been spoken with the pulpit? I mean, I attended the funeral of a Unitarian friend where the sermon was blasphemous.
Yeah.
I didn't stand up and protest. That would have been disgraceful behavior, I think, in the context, and very distressing. I think there's a certain civic decency that applies in that situation. But the question, you know, would you provide a cake? Would my wife have provided a cake for that event? Is perhaps might be a useful analogy.
I kind of want to push that conversation a little bit further and ask, given what we've said about identity groups, can the Christian ever make the case that they are an identity group? That it is so fundamental to their being that they are easily oppressed? According to the terms that the culture uses, can we claim to be an identity group? Can we say we have a Christian orientation?
The Christian gene.
The Christian
gene. That would
be
useful if we could discover that, wouldn't it?
Right. I mean... Part of me is just trying to be a burr in this battle, but to me, that's where we have to go at a civil level if we're going to engage in the direction of the culture. So I just wonder if you have thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think, on one level, in the pure abstract, yes, I think we could make that case. And it's the kind of thing that one of my favorite writers is Camille Paglia, she's actually a lesbian, but she's the feminists hate her because she's so utterly consistent in the way she applies things. Her little essay, The Joy of Presbyterian Sex, is the best debunking of the gay rights lobby within the church I've ever read. No Christian has ever matched that for rhetoric and brilliance. Yes, we could claim that, but then I think you're going to bump up against the fact that it isn't just, and Paglia makes this point, it isn't just about law. It's also about the power of lobby groups. And I think the problem is we don't have a powerful lobby group. Well, we've had a powerful lobby group for a long time, and I think probably overplayed our hand massively and are now looking at a big reaction setting in against that. So, yes, in theory we could do that, but in practice I don't think it'll work any more than, say, the Ku Klux Klan claiming to be an identity will work. We have an illegitimate identity.
Kind of following up on what Dave just said, do you think that there could be a sense in which there could be a danger for Christians to adopt a mindset of victimhood in light of, you know, the kinds of challenges that we're facing? And if so, what kinds of things might you counsel to try to guard against slipping into that kind of mindset?
Yes, I think there's definite... I think we have to be very careful about victimhood because one can end up setting precedents that can come back to haunt you. I mean, there are Christians in the UK who sort of campaigning against blasphemous adverts, commercials, that kind of thing. On the one hand, I sympathize with, yes, we don't want blasphemous commercials. On the other hand, we don't want to set legal precedents where the government decides what you can see and what you can't see. Because once it's on the statute books, it could just as easily be used against you when somebody decides that what you're doing is offensive. So I think we have to be very careful how we play the victimhood card from a legal precedent point of view often. I don't find much whining in Paul. When I read the New Testament, he doesn't whine a lot. He doesn't whine about the fact that Nero isn't a Christian and that Christians aren't being represented in the Senate in Rome. The victim mentality, Paul can sometimes present himself rhetorically as a victim, and that's to establish his credentials as an apostle. or to show that he can play that card just as well as the next man. But he doesn't really build positively on victimhood. And united to Christ, Colossians talks about our sufferings in some, you know, profound way. Paul is filling up what's lacking in Christ's sufferings. Now, he doesn't mean that we're dying for our sins in the way that Christ does, but it seems to me that the vision that Paul sets forth of the church is that the church will suffer in various ways. And that's to be expected and not to be whined about. Paul rejoices in his sufferings. So I would say theologically, there's a problem with playing the victim card. The church in America has enjoyed spectacular influence and comfort for centuries. And that's not a little thing, and it's not to be despised. We should be grateful for that. But I think we should not whine when those things are removed, because, if you like, the life the church has enjoyed for the last couple of hundred years, that's the exception, not the rule, by and large, is what the New Testament lays out. So I would say victimhood, one, there are all kinds of legal problems that I'd want to think about if we start playing the sort of the law courts game. And the other issue is, Paul doesn't really play the victim card. I don't see it as a New Testament virtue to be a victim. Paul says, you know, these, compared to the surpassing weight of glory, this is just a momentary affliction. That's not really whining as a victim, I don't think.
With the idea in mind that all human history begins and ends with a wedding between one man and one woman, do you see the cultural assault on monogamous heterosexuality as an assault on the Father's ultimate intention to bring forth the church as a bride for his son?
Well, that's interesting. I never thought of that, but that's an interesting thought. Yeah, I guess I'd seen it more as an assault upon the, you know, in the image of God he made them, male and female. But that is an interesting idea, that the disbanding of marriage is the final dissolution of God's purposes for humanity. I like that. I'll have to think about that. I can't say yes or no. I'd like to think about it. But that strikes me as a very plausible suggestion. Thanks.
Yes, you mentioned the death of the pastor of the Westboro Baptist Church. And a lot of the culture sees them as being representative of Christians. Do you think homophobia is a problem in the church? And, you know, how do we separate our real our biblical convictions from a real, you know, I talk to a lot of Christians, a lot of Christian men.
Yeah.
Who, you know, are repulsed, yeah, by homosexuals.
Yeah.
And, you know, how do we overcome this perception of homophobia?
Yeah. It's a difficult one. We had a little, it's odd to say, I don't like using the language, I'm really proud of the congregation where I served about a year ago, but I was. We do this outreach in a local park where I read a C.S. Lewis book. And we just invite people from the local neighborhoods to come and sit and listen while I read one of the Narnia books over 5 nights. And the 2 years we've done it, we've had a couple of gay guys come to listen every night. First year they were there, they were knitting, and somebody said to me, a couple of gay guys. I said, come on, stereotype. Just because they're knitting doesn't mean they're gay. But turns out they were. Well, one night last year, it rained, so we couldn't meet in the park. We had to meet at the church, and they turned up in the church, and I just observed how the congregation treated them, and they just treated them like anybody else who'd walked in off the street, and I thought that was great, and it may reflect the fact that we have a younger congregation in profile, that a lot of people in our church probably went to school in the 90s and beyond, where cultural attitudes are very different to what I grew up with in the 70s and 80s. Yeah, well, my own taste of this was I did a guy back in the UK wrote a little book on same-sex attraction and his own struggles with same-sex attraction. And I was asked if I would do a jacket commendation for it. And that's the kind of book, you know, sometimes I do jacket commendations and I'll read the book, but I read them pretty quickly. When you're asked to do a jacket commendation for a book like that, you read it very carefully. And I read it, and I thought it was really good, and I did a jacket commendation. I said, this book will help. I think this book will help people struggling with same-sex attraction. I got a ferocious response from some people because I commended a book where a Christian still struggled with same-sex attraction. And that struck me as interesting. That clearly, and it was interesting that the person that I got the really vicious reaction from was a guy in his 60s. And part of me thought, this is a generational thing, that that's the one sin that apparently you're immediately healed of as soon as you're converted, as soon as you become a Christian, which strikes me as inherently unlikely, given as how powerful, without wanting to reduce ourselves to our sexuality, I think our sexuality is a very powerful part of who we are and how we think of ourselves. So it strikes me as inherently unlikely that when you're converted, particularly if you've been deeply involved in a gay lifestyle, it's simply going to vanish like that. You know, you might still struggle with pornography or gambling or whatever, but homosexuality, no, that goes straight away.
We have to believe in some sort of Christian.
I think it connects to that. And that did make me think that, yeah, we've got to be careful that we treat homosexuality as it is the big issue of our generation in many ways. But on the other hand, we don't want to so demonize it that we don't see that, you know, we don't see it as one sin among a number of others. Now, I know Paul puts special emphasis on sexual sins. There's sins against the body, and you know, there's all kinds of problems relating to sexual sin that he doesn't necessarily connect to other sins. But we do need to realize that homosexuality, while the world around us is making it the big special deal of the moment, for us it's only one of the problems that we have to face as a church. So I do think homophobia in the church is... I would say, certainly for guys my age and older, I just don't like homosexuality, you know. Before I became a Christian, I hated homosexuality. I had no biblical basis for it. It just struck me as effeminate. You know, I remember when a friend's... This shows how I instinctively... Just a couple of years ago, a friend's son came out, and when I was told, this friend from Britain, my reaction was, but he can't be a homosexual. He played rugby for his school. And I thought to myself, that was an interesting reaction. And that shows that, yeah, there's a lot of dislike of people still in my own heart here, rather than just a principial objection to the sin.
Kind of piggyback on that, the last couple of questions. So I'm going to start with an example. So when I went through a divorce a number of years ago, my brother was very kind and welcoming and had me over his house a few nights a week as I was going through a major life change. And the thing is, he is a homosexual. And recently the topic came up as having not set foot in a church for roughly 4 years after leaving the Roman Catholic priesthood, which he was a part of for 4 years. He's suddenly sort of desiring to maybe attend church on occasion and whatnot. I know he went to some Episcopal Christmas service. And, the question arose, hey, maybe Tim and I could come to your church sometime. Is your church gay friendly?
Yeah.
So, of course we are, and I'd like to think that we would welcome or treat them like any two normal people.
Yeah.
Just like you described the members of your congregation. But at the end of the day, there's still the issue of there being an inherent sin.
Yeah.
And there's a certain point where that has to be addressed.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, you know, yes, we are gay friendly. but not by his definition. This whole hate speech thing has become pretty normal, where it used to be you could say 10, 20 years ago, you could get away with hate the sin, love the sinner, or something like that. Now, if you even call it a sin, you're a hater out of the box. So how do we get from, yes, we are gay-friendly on our terms, to them thinking we're friendly? I mean, I'm not even sure what I'm asking, but how do we deal with the issue of loving these people, welcoming them into our churches, but eventually, the truth's got to come out.
Sure.
We believe that's a sin.
Sure. So, well, I think on one level, clearly the personal relationship aspect with your brother is very important, and just being a good brother and a friend and kind to him as he's been to you one-on-one outside of church, that's vital. I think when people come to church, and it doesn't matter if they're homosexual, if they're non-Christians, they're probably going to find the church an odd place these days, and something's going to be said that's going to rub them up the wrong way. I think there are, this is where it comes down to me, to the sovereignty of God. I don't know who's going to turn up to my church on Sunday. I just preach the text week after week after week as I work through the Bible. And I would trust that if the Lord brings your brother to the church, then on that Sunday there'll be a word for him. I think in all the time I've been preaching at Cornerstone, which must be now for, I've been preaching there for 4 years pretty consistently, I probably addressed homosexuality once when it came up in the text. And if a homosexual had been in the church that day, might have come up to me and said, "You're a hater." I'd have said, "Well, I addressed it because it's in the text. I don't address it every week. And if you come next week, I'm going to be bashing people who gossip. And the week after that, I'm going to be bashing people who are envious or drunkards." I don't think there's much we can do about that. As I said, I would just go back to, as I was alluding to in the talk, I think the Rosaria Butterfield. You earn the right to speak. I mean, go back to the couple that came to my church. I've been thinking, we lease a building. Maybe at some point we'll lose the lease and we have to look for somewhere else in the borough to meet. And I can imagine these days it's going to be getting tougher and tougher to be able to lease a new place to be a church if you're not gay-friendly in your brother's sense of the word. I hope that that couple have been, and actually one of them's come to church a couple of times. I hope that if nothing else, they would, I feel I could probably call them up and say, "We're in a tight spot here. We're not being allowed to meet to worship. Would you be willing to speak for us?" And I think that they'd probably say, "We don't agree with your theology, but we know you don't hate us because of the way you treated us at the times we've come to church." So I think that the personal relational aspect is vital. I worry less about the preaching because the preaching is just the text week after week after week for me. And I just have to trust that the Lord brings the right people to church on the right Sunday for the right text. I have no control over that. So I would say to you, be a good friend and a good brother and pray that the Lord will bring your brother to church one Sunday and he'll bring him on the right Sunday when the text just speaks to him. Take it a step further. Your brother's convicted of his sin and applies for membership. Then I think you move into the session, then get involved. And I would say, I'd understand that if I had a gay couple come to me and ask for membership and we have to say to them, you've got to separate. You can't continue to live together. That it's not sufficient for me as a pastor to say that. That the church then has to rally round and provide the emotional support to help that kind of breakup of a relationship. So I would say, if you move to the next level, they apply for membership, one would have to ask some very hard questions and take some very hard actions. But I think the church is like a girl coming and saying, "I'm pregnant, want to have an abortion." I don't think as a minister I can just say, "No, you can't, and if you do, we'll discipline you." I think I have to say to her, "No, you can't, but these are the women in the church who are going to help you." I think the next stage would be the church then has to rally around and support people. It's not enough to say no. We have to provide support as people move forward. Difficult to generalize because everybody's different.
And I think maybe there's a part of me that just finds it very doubtful that my brother would become convicted of a sin. It's probably a lack of faith on my own part.
With God, all things are possible.
Yeah.
That's trite, but it's also true. I'll put it that way.
During your talk this morning, you mentioned about how the church had missed the boat with the $295 no-fault divorce, and that's really when she should have spoken out. I recall a number of years ago reading a short article in Table Talk magazine where the writer started with the premise that today's society is not listening to what's coming out of the pulpit, and that is responsible for a lot of the ills of society. He then went on to explain, no, society is still turning to the pulpit for what's coming out of it to live by, but what's coming out of the pulpit is not the Word of God.
Mm.
It's a bunch of, it's a bunch of just nothing.
Yeah.
Really, it's coming out of the pulpit. So you're saying, no, society is still turning to the pulpit for guidance.
Yeah.
But what they're receiving for guidance today is what they're living out.
Yeah.
It's not guidance from the Scriptures.
Yeah.
So how do we combat that, in our nation's pulpit?
That's hard. I mean, obviously, good training of ministers is vital. I think there's a big paradigm shift that underlies that. think it's Brooks Hollifield wrote a book on the history of pastoral care in the United States, showing how the whole conception of the pastorate had become a psychological therapeutic thing over the last 200 years. So I think there's a bigger question about what the pastorate means. And I'm very, you know, I hammer at Westminster in my class, I hammer home word and sacrament, ordinary means of grace. That's the basic model. But that's not the dominant model in the United States. And I was talking with somebody last night. I always love seeing John MacArthur on the television. I have issues with J-Mac's theology, but what a guy. You know, you get him on with a female Episcopal priest and a Lutheran liberal guy and John MacArthur, and you know that within 30 seconds, John MacArthur's going to say something that's A, true, and B, has offended 95% of the people watching the program. Bless him. There are pulpits in this country that still get public exposure where the truth is spoken, and John MacArthur's one of them. But those programs are always interesting. You know that MacArthur's just been brought on there to be the offensive one. The ones they bring on to really represent the church, the female Episcopal priest and the liberal Lutheran and the Jesuit Catholic. But I think you're right. We need good training. We need churches that model good ministry. It's amazing what people can learn just by sitting under good ministry without ever being told what good ministry is. I have two sons, and before my wife could drive, she learned to drive in the last couple of years. When I went away, she and the boys would go to the church at the end of the road. It was a walk away. It was PCOSA, Evangelical PCOSA. It's now an EPC church. It's where my wife works during the week. Minister there is a good gospel-believing guy, but there was an assistant minister who's a woman there. And my wife went there one Sunday and the assistant minister was preaching. So my wife and I, we never trash churches to our kids, but we're always interested in their reaction. And when I got home that night, I said, boys, oh, what was church like this morning? And one said, well, it was, oh, there was a woman preaching. And I said, well, what do you think about that? And she said, well, he said, it wasn't so much the fact it was a woman preaching. And my son was about 9 at the time, he said, but her sermon was very superficial. And that's great, because I never told him what a non-superficial sermon is. We just made sure that he never sat under superficial sermons, so he could spot one when it came up. And I think that the way the church teaches people well is to make sure that it has good teachers in its pulpit. Can't change things overnight, but train men well and put the right men in the pulpits, and that's the foundation for addressing the problem that you're pointing to.